Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. You won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
Great week as the summer winds down. What an interesting week of news. A ton of variety, including, of course, the passing of Aretha Franklin. Somewhat expected, as we heard this week she wasn't doing well and that she hasn't been in good health, but also unexpected in that her health wasn't a huge topic of conversation going into this summer. And you know, I was reflecting a little bit on her talent, but overall her impact. And I was thinking, you know, no matter who you are in this country and beyond, you can probably sing part of R.E.S.P.E.C.T. What a legacy to leave behind. And one of the things about Aretha Franklin I learned this week, and I was especially charmed by, was that she told the New York Post a few years ago that she used to take her walks in super Walmarts for exercise. And the reason why she liked Walmarts is that she said you could find things there that you can't find anywhere else. And I totally relate to this because when I grew up in San Francisco, there were no Walmarts. There was a Walgreens and a Five and Dime, but there wasn't a Walmart. And still, when I go into Walmart now, I'm excited. In my husband's hometown, there's a super Walmart, and it's amazing. I mean, there's so much stuff in there. So I had a little bonding moment reading about Aretha Franklin because I totally understand her sentiment. And I liked that in many ways, despite her fame, despite her fortune and her accomplishments, she's just like us. So sad to hear about her passing, but also nice to have some moments to honor someone that gave so much to the country and really to the world through her voice. So let's get to the top three things I think you should know for the week that I believe will make you smarter, including the big story out of Washington. And that big story is not the new strategy to combat Mexican drug cartels or the higher number of opioid deaths or ISIS. But in fact, it's that this former CIA director, John Brennan, lost his security clearance. And I think, although that's an important story, it really misses an opportunity to talk about the bigger picture. And here is the bigger picture. A recent report revealed 1.4 million Americans, like John Brennan, have top secret security clearances. That report is from the Government Accountability Office, who said that the sheer number of Americans with security clearances and the lack of oversight and consistency of review is a real threat to our national security. So I think it's important to take a step outside of this story being a personal issue between the former CIA director and the current president and ask, who are all these people, 4 million plus, walking around with security clearances indefinitely because they received it at one time and that's what we've always done? It's an interesting question and one I think we should continue to ask. In the meantime, we're going to move from Washington, D.C. out to California, to the state capital, in fact, of Sacramento. And I almost missed this story about an alleged ISIS terrorist arrested in Sacramento for the murder of an Iraqi police officer in Iraq. So here's the story. Apparently, he was affiliated with ISIS and Al-Qaeda at one time, and he posed as a refugee, according to the Department of Justice, to get into America. And so this is a small story, but it reflects the bigger picture of some recent reports that emphasize that ISIS and the threat of ISIS has not gone away. In fact, tens of thousands of ISIS fighters remain in Iraq and Syria. And this story, looking into these reports and also the story out of California, really underline a variety of truths. And here's what I mean by that. When the president says ISIS has been defeated, he's referring to a military defeat, a loss of territory. And that is true. But that doesn't mean the threat of ISIS is gone. ISIS is still a threat, and that can also be true. So think about that. We're going to stay in California for a moment because I was recently there visiting. And when I'm visiting my parents, we were actually in wine country. I wasn't drinking wine, unfortunately. But I did do a lot of reading. And I like reading the local papers and catching up on magazines. And a story that stood out to me was about orange wine. Orange wine. It's not made from oranges. It's just amber colored wine. So white wine is made with no grape skins. But orange wine allows a little rendezvous with the skins. And that's where the color comes from. And apparently, it's one of the oldest forms of wine around. But I've never heard of it. And here's what else I found out. I thought I was onto something brand new, like orange wine was a big discovery, which was not true. In fact, every few years, as I did a little research, orange wine has come up as a topic of conversation, wondering if orange wine is going to be the next big thing. One of the reasons why it's coming up now is that rosé wine drinking has grown so much. In fact, sales of rosé have gone up more than 50% last year. So now the question is, well, what's the next rosé? Will it be orange-tinted wine? So if you try orange-tinted wine or orange wine, please let me know what you think because I haven't been able to find it. And if I do, of course, I'm going to report back and share that with you. Speaking of adventures, we have an incredible guest this week for the podcast. He's an Ohio high school teacher who decided not to spend his summer relaxing on the beach, but somewhere different completely. He decided to row solo, unsupported, across the northern Atlantic. So that's from Canada to England. A notoriously rocky trip, an understatement perhaps. And he did this in record time and not without some very interesting experiences along the way. He spent 38 days at sea. So I started out our conversation asking Bryce Carlson, what's it like being back on solid ground?
You know, it's funny how quickly the mind adapts, I think. You know, while I'm out on the ocean, you know, I got used to the ocean. I got used to being out there in the minute to minute, the day to day. And then, you know, as soon as I get back on dry land, the mind is like, oh yeah, this is what it's like to be around people. And this is what it's like to walk. And this is what, you know, you acclimate very quickly. At least I find I've acclimated very quickly. Well, to being back around people in some ways. Yeah.
I think that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is the loneliness of being out in the ocean, because you were on the ocean for 38 days. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you did have some contact, but it's not like you sat down next to someone and had a real conversation face to face. So what was that?
Right. Well, you know, in some ways I did. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I didn't have any conversations face to face, but with the satellite phone that I was using, it allowed me to send like text messages just as you would, you know, from your iPhone or from your, you know, from your Android or whatever. And so I was able to communicate with my friend Alex and with my girlfriend Priya, on a pretty regular basis. I send them a message and within a few seconds they would get it and, you know, they could reply and within a few seconds I'd get it. And so we were able to have interactive conversations in that way pretty regularly. And being able to communicate what I was feeling and seeing and hearing with Alex and Priya and to have them translate that into social media posts and then for them to share with me what, you know, the community on social media was, how they were responding to that. I mean, that helped me feel like, you know, I wasn't out there doing this alone, that I was a part of a greater community, that I was, you know, sharing the experience, that I was taking them with me on the experience. And so, I don't know, I think for me, it made me feel a connectivity that you might not expect. Being alone out there, you know?
Well, one of the silver linings of social media, perhaps, because we talk so much about it being negative, because it's easy to get obsessed with it, but you forget
for sure.
That it often does make you feel part of something bigger than yourself. And that could be really positive. So,
yeah, in my experience, I think it really was. And, you know, I think now that I'm back, you know, I'm also reminded about how, you know, we can become consumed in these social, in these online social media worlds, and ignore the physical world around us. You know, when we are surrounded by, you know, wonderful people,
yes.
in
yes.
wonderful environments, you know, to live in that virtual space rather than the actual space, you know, that can become problematic too. Yes. And I'm certainly aware of that.
Well, I have a funny story for you. Last night, my husband was gone for most of the day, and I knew we were trying to figure out an interview time, and I just wanted to make sure my kids wouldn't interrupt me here in the morning at my house. And sure. So when he got home late at night, I said, listen, are you going to be around in the morning? Because I have this really interesting interview that I'd like to do. And he said, oh yeah, I'm here. You know, what is this about? And just for some background, my husband was a Navy SEAL. He deployed 3 times to Iraq and, you know, has done a lot of dangerous things in his life. And so I explained to him, I said, well, I'm talking to this teacher who is the first American to go solo across the North Atlantic in a rowboat. And he set some records. And so I just sort of gave him the general, you know, the general overview. Mm-hmm. And he stopped and he looked at me and goes, that sounds quite hazardous.
Yeah.
And I said, well, coming from you, that's sort of interesting, Leif. I said, I'm going to have to ask Bryce about that. So how hazardous was it?
I mean, it was pretty hazardous, but I think it's it's a matter of a controlled risk, right? Just in business, you enter into a new business. I don't think there are many entrepreneurs that just blindly jump into a new business, right? There's some calculated risk, and they, just as an entrepreneur looks at the landscape and says, I think there's a place here for this business model or something, there's a lot of risks. It might fail, but they look at the landscape and they say, but I think it's possible. I think the risks are there, but they're manageable, they're controllable. And given, your a background, a training, a mindset, I think I can navigate that. And I think it was similar for me. I looked at this adventure, I said, yeah, there's obviously some risk, some pretty massive risk. But I felt given my background, I was a collegiate rower for 4 years. I've been involved in the sport of rowing for a further 15 years as a coach. I've been competing for about 10 years as an ultra endurance athlete, mostly running events. And I just felt, that I had a sufficient background to be able to pull it off. I guess I benefited tremendously from, the 15 or so other people who have done this, that have rowed solo across the North Atlantic and written books or created documentaries to share their story. And I benefited tremendously from, those that attempted but failed, and told their story. And I benefited tremendously by sailors who've gotten out on, the big waters and talked about what that experience is like. So I was able to read a lot about the experiences of others and learn from their mistakes and successes and put together my own plan. And so while there was certainly a tremendous amount of risk, I felt like I was able to wrap my head around what that risk, what that risk was all about, like what the greatest challenges were, and put together a plan for how I would manage those risks, how I would get through it. Just as I imagine, a soldier or a special ops in particular, a soldier gets through a challenge in war. You define the nature of the challenge that you're facing. You put together a plan for how you're going to get in there, get the mission done, and get out with, minimizing risk and casualty and that.
Well, one of the things that Leif talks about is no matter how much you prepare, and that's so important to prepare in real life situations, and no matter how much you think through every scenario, there's always going to be something that comes up that is totally unexpected. And so what was that for you on this journey?
I don't know that there was anything that was completely unexpected. I can say, I can tell you, like, a lot of the things that happened to me, like losing my sea anchor, water maker breaking, electronics inside the boat kind of going on the fritz. All of those things were things things I had read about before. One of the things that surprised me a little bit is that I didn't expect them all to happen to me. I expected
and talk us through that, Bryce, because I've never rowed and I don't sail. So although I read about losing your water maker and can understand why fresh water is important, I have a harder time understanding, for example, why the sea anchor is important, or why when you use duct tape on your radio, why that was so important. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I'll start with the water maker. I mean, that's the most essential piece of equipment on the boat when it comes to survival, you know. And so I knew, you know, I wanted to make sure I had some spare parts on board in case it broke that I could try to fix it. I wanted to make sure that if I didn't have power that I could operate it manually. I wanted to make sure that if the whole thing broke, I had a backup. And so I planned for redundancy on that one. And thankfully, even though when the first one broke and the spare parts I had couldn't get it fixed, I had the backup water maker. So I could just resort to that. The Sea Anchor is a really valuable, if not essential, piece of equipment in that while you are drifting, while you're not propelling the boat with human power, if you are facing adverse winds, so the winds are blowing the boat in a direction you don't want to be going, the Sea Anchor can help limit that drift. So, for example, if I had winds coming out of the east blowing me back west, having the Sea Anchor would keep me kind of rooted to that body of water, that place, so I don't get blown, you know, miles and miles back west. So it's not essential, but it's nice, right? Because you're not losing miles. The other nice thing about the Sea Anchor is that it helps keep your bow pointed into the wind, which is actually really valuable for your comfort and for preventing capsizes. So if you don't use the Sea Anchor, you just let the boat drift, the boat wants to go align kind of parallel with oncoming waves. And so as waves are coming in, if you're sitting parallel with it, if the waves kind of crash onto the boat, it's very easy for the boat then to get rolled over. So with the Sea Anchor, you throw it off the bow of the boat and it creates a lot of drag. And so the wind keeps pushing the boat, but now the bow is pointed into the wind because you have this big anchor dragging in the water in front of the boat. And so the boat rides a lot more comfortably and safely in that kind of circumstance. So once I lost that anchor, it meant, one, I was drifting a lot more, whether in directions I wanted or directions I didn't want. And it meant that in big weather conditions, it was a little more difficult to keep my boat pointed into the wind. And the boat would more frequently get parallel with the waves and roll.
And how big was your boat, Lucille, her name?
She was 20 feet long, about 4.5 feet wide.
And how big were some of the waves that you sailed through, rode through?
So I rode through up to 16-foot swells.
Wow.
And, waves on top of swells maybe reached, I'm not entirely sure, maybe 7 to 10 feet. So those are the ones that get really nasty. The swells, the boat just kind of floats up and then back down. They tend to be much larger waves that don't really crash on the boat. It's the smaller waves that come on top of the swells that can get particularly nasty. And the combination of the two together, depending if they're both coming in the same direction or if they're coming from different directions, you know, so sometimes I'd get swells from the west and then waves from the south. So the boat, you know, the boat's maybe riding with the swells. So the swells are coming up behind me and then passing, but the waves are coming from the side. And that gets pretty dangerous in terms of rolling the boat. And uncomfortable.
Which it did happen that your boat capsized several times. Did you ever think that it wasn't going to, because I read that the boat was constructed that it was going to, if it capsized, that it would come back up. But did you ever wonder if it was going to right itself?
There was, I didn't ever really, the answer is no, with a caveat. There was one time the boat took a little bit longer to right itself. Partly because I hadn't secured, all of, I guess the bags, the load inside the cabin. I hadn't secured everything down, as well as I had previously, or as well as I should have. And so when the boat went upside down, I had a couple really heavy bags and some other gear kind of fall to the ceiling, with me. And under those circumstances, there's now a lot more weight, on what is now the bottom of the boat, the ceiling. which was stabilizing the boat in that upside down position. So normally the self-righting properties of the boat are dependent on there being a lot of buoyancy up high on the boat and a lot of weight down low on the boat. So when it goes upside down, all that weight is now up high and the buoyancy is down low, and it's very unstable in that configuration. So it rights itself back up. But with all this weight having fallen to the ceiling, now it was much more stable in that position, and it just took a little longer and a little help from me, kind of leaning and to one side to help pull the boat back over. But I mean, it's a difference of the boat might normally right itself in maybe 10 seconds, and that time it took maybe 30 seconds.
Oh, okay.
Or a minute. So, I mean, no real fear or concern.
I still don't think I would have loved the feeling of being capsized in the middle of the North Atlantic.
It certainly wasn't fun. You know, I'm not going to lie. And there were a number of times when the boat rolled and I got bruised up a bit for it. You know, it kind of depended if I was laying down in the cabin, it tended to be a softer experience. If I was sitting up in the middle of the cabin, it tended to be a little rougher. So if I was sitting up, I'd often get slammed into the instrument panel or the electrical panel. You know, and like little knobs and things sticking out, and I had some cuts and bruises. One capsize, I bruised my tailbone pretty bad. That was in some pain from that for a few days. But you know, in general, I got kind of used to it, in the sense that it the first time I capsized, it was a big kind of scary thing. And after a little while, you know, I grew accustomed to the idea that yeah, the boat may roll; it's not a big deal.
Was there ever a moment during this trip, during the 38 days, where you thought, I'm not sure I'm going to make it to the other side?
Yeah. Very early, the first week, you know, when the water maker went out on the first day and then water poured into the cabin on like the third or fourth day, I saw water pouring out from behind the electrical panel. And I knew previous rows had really become derailed from, you know, previous rows by other people had become derailed when their electronics all went out and they couldn't communicate, with land, and they couldn't navigate properly. And I'm just envisioning my row ending there, you know, with all the electronics being fried on day three. So thankfully the electronics continued to work. But they became less and less reliable as the trip went on. So there was some anxiety about whether they were going to hold up, whether the electronics were going to hold up. But I very quickly began working on backup strategies. Like, all right, what happens if the navigational system goes out? Thankfully, I had paper navigational charts. And I had several devices that I could get my GPS coordinates from. So, you know, I started practicing using those other devices and how I would use those to continue to navigate. And so, like, the anxiety was always there, you know, that these things might give out. But, I gained more and more confidence as the trip went on, as I became more and more comfortable with the backup strategy if they ultimately failed.
Why did you pick the North Atlantic?
The simplest answer is that it was the only... So once I made the decision that I wanted to row across an ocean, that was the only body of water that fit in the time that I had available to do it. I'm a high school teacher. I'm very fortunate to have summers, some free time in the summers to take on adventures like this and to help me learn and grow in ways that are valuable in the classroom. But also like that are mentally rejuvenating, you know? So I had a couple months in the summer, and it turns out the North Atlantic, like the weather window for being out on the North Atlantic, it's safest in the summer and it's, most dangerous in the winter. And other bodies of water one might row, like the Mid-Atlantic, from the Canary Islands to the Caribbean, that weather window opens up in the winter. So those who row from the Canary Islands to the Caribbean, they tend to set out in December and finish in January or February. And, you know, that just wouldn't work with my teaching schedule. But the other reason the North Atlantic really appealed to me is, you know, my ancestors came over to the U.S. from Scandinavia, from Northern Europe. Our family has always celebrated that ancestry and that cultural heritage. And so part of me felt this connection with, you know, the Vikings who, you know, 1,000 years ago were out sailing and rowing on these North Atlantic waters. And so part of me felt like I was connecting with my ancestors out there as well.
That's really cool. I was thinking about not just your journey, but those before you, when you mentioned it, that you had you read different people that had made this row. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think about as well the people that did it when there was no electronics and there was, you know, there wasn't the water machines that we have now, and how they did it. I mean, when you really think about it, you must have a whole new appreciation for that journey and what
it takes
to sail and explore into the unknown.
Well, yeah, for sure. Right. And I mean, there's in so many ways, our lives today are easier than they were for our ancestors. Right. I mean, you know, every year with technology and innovation improves our quality of life in measurable and immeasurable ways. And so I think part of the adventure of taking on challenges like this is that, you know, I feel like I'm reconnecting in some small way with some of the hardships that, you know, our ancestors took on in some ways involuntarily, you know, that they had to endure. But I'm doing so today, you know, in a way that's much more, safer than they did back then. But I mean, I think that's part of the learning and growing process of taking on these kind of adventures.
And you had some beautiful descriptions of some experience as well, whether with krill or bioluminescent plankton, right? I have that right. And whales.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about that part, because for me, I'm afraid of the open water. I love the ocean, but the idea of being on the open water, like what you did, is something that would frighten me. But I loved reading about these other parts, about the beautiful things that you saw that most of us will never get to experience.
Well, I think it frightened me a little bit too. You know, I'd never spent any great deal amount of time out on the open water. And even though I've spent years reading about ocean life, it's still a little intimidating. You know, it's still an unknown. You know, you look at the surface of the water and that's there, and you have very little idea of what's going on underneath that the surface. And there was some fear is probably too strong a word, but I mean, there's some anxiety that, you know, I had some anxiety about that too, but you know, I think I chose to focus on the things I could control, the things that I could see, you know. So focus on the beauty of the seabirds, focus on how amazing it was to be visited by dolphins and the bioluminescent plankton. And these were all things that I'd been long fascinated with and been reading about since I was a kid. And this was really the first time I got to see it in life and sit really in awe of that experience.
How do you think this will impact your teaching?
You know, I think I can more confidently encourage my students to dream big because I've done it and lived it. I can encourage my students to define their own path rather than following the path that's been clearly laid out for them. You know, I'm a biology teacher, and many of our students, the only application of biology in quote unquote the real world that they're aware of is to go into medicine. You know, like how, you know, what does one do with a degree in biology? Well, they know one could become a doctor. You know, but that's a path that's pretty well trodden. It's pretty well laid out. And, you know, if a student really wants to become a doctor, I'd absolutely encourage them to take that path. But, you know, I also encourage them to explore widely. Well, there are a lot of other aspects to biology, right? You know, there are a lot of other things you could study, a lot of other things you could do and apply that knowledge to. So, you know, I think as a teacher, after having had this experience, I can more confidently encourage them to define their own path and choose a direction that hasn't been well trodden by a number of others before.
I can't wait to see their reaction and maybe hear some of their reaction when you get back to school. Because I both think students can, teenagers especially, can be very impressed and then not impressed at all.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right. You know, I read one quote from the New York Times that I wanted to ask you about, because you've said, you know, people are always looking for like the big meaning. And I admit sometimes I am too, like the big meat. What is the secret to life that you found in, during this journey? And you've said, well, listen, can you give me a couple weeks because I need to reflect back on it. But one of the quotes that stood with me is this. You said, spending any mental energy looking back cannot help you move forward. And that really resonated with me. And is that something that you learned just on this journey, or is that from all of your different athletic adventures? And how do you think that... Do you think that rose to the surface?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing, you know, I think quotes are a funny thing. You know, they're almost always taken a little bit out of context.
True. Yes. This is why part of the reason I started my own news platform. Yes.
Yeah.
You need the context. So tell us.
With that one, I don't. And that, yeah, that particular quote, a number of people have kind of grabbed that one. I would add some caveats to that now if you push me. And that is, you know, I do think it's important to look back and reflect, right? I mean, I think that it's important to learn from past experiences. But I think that particular comment came out of a question that a reporter asked about, you know, did you ever question why you were there? Did you ever question the decision you made to begin the journey? Did you ever wish you hadn't started? And my comment, like, you know, spending any mental energy looking back isn't going to help me move forward, is really in the context of, I've decided I'm going to do this. Like, I'm out here, I'm doing it. So looking back and questioning whether I should be here or not is completely irrelevant to helping me get to the finish line. And so that, I do think, is I would still absolutely hold to that kind of perspective. And I think that philosophy, if we want to call it that, I think largely came out of all the years I spent in ultra endurance races. You know, when you're running a 100-mile race, or when I'm running a 100-mile race, there are definitely moments where you're thinking, why did I sign up for this? This, you know, I'm not ready for this. I'm not strong enough for this. This is a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. But, you know, I've also had enough experience with those things to know that that kind of thinking isn't helping me at all. You know, it's not helping me get to the finish. It's not helping me get out of that kind of critical, negative, self-doubt space and get back to a more positive, affirmational, I can do this, I am going to do this kind of a mental state. And so over the course of the row, I was very actively cultivating a positive, affirmational mindset. And I had a number of ways in which I did that. You know, music is a great tool, you know, to find, you know, find happy music, music that makes you happy, music that keeps you positive, music that helps keep you motivated and excited. So I think that's really important.
And I
was also going to say, and we can talk a little more about this if you're interested. You know, I have had a little more time to reflect in over the last few days, and I think there are a number of other lessons that I've certainly learned.
Lay it on us. We're ready. We want to know, because very few of us are going to do this, and from what I understand, you're not going to probably do it again. So
that's probably true. Yeah.
So while you're fresh, what are the big takeaways?
Well, I just think one thing that's interesting, you know, is that I think we recognize that procrastination is a vice, you know, and we try to avoid it in our schoolwork, at work, in our home lives. But I think too often we're willing to procrastinate when it comes to living our dreams, you know. And I think we should probably all practice living out our ideas a little more, rather than just letting our ideas stay ideas or our dreams stay dreams, that we should practice like actually doing it. You know, why wait until, you know, fill in the blank year or to go out and do this thing, to do this vacation, to take on this project? Like, I think we should probably just do it a little more often, right? And starting with little things, just like enacting, living a little idea, starts to give us the confidence and courage to start taking action to live out our big ideas too.
I think that's a great takeaway. I really believe in that. And it's easier said than done sometimes, but it's, you need the reminders, because if no one reminds you about it, you're 100% right. These things all become visions that you are constantly pursuing in some way, but never really doing.
Right. And, well, I think it's like a muscle, you know, with all things, the more you flex it, the stronger it gets. And so I do think you're right. It is a big ask to tell someone who hasn't really lived out their big ideas to all of a sudden take the leap, take the jump, you know, quit your job and begin that startup that you've been dreaming about. That's a big ask. But if you start by living out little things, little ideas, you know, like I've been wanting to go to this museum, this local museum for years, and I just haven't gotten around to doing it. Well, that's a small ask. Just say, this Saturday, I'm going to go do it. I'm going to go see that museum. And I think when you start living out some of those little ideas, gradually, again, you build up the confidence and the courage to start taking action on the bigger ideas.
Yes, I think it's such a good reminder. And speaking of that, do you have your next big idea?
Oh,
I don't
no.
want to rush you, but yeah. I mean, ultra marathons, marathons, you got this one under your belt. I mean, yeah. I'm a little nervous about the next thing or whether or not maybe yeah. you're shifting into something different, you know?
Yeah, I can say I do not suffer from a shortage of ideas, of things that sound really fun that I would love to go do. But I can also say that whatever that adventure may be in the future, I'm pretty confident that it won't be nearly as risky as this row. I mean, I think that kind of high adventure where my life is really on the line, I mean, I think this is the peak for me. I don't see myself going back to that well again and putting my family and loved ones through that kind of anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, whether I'll come home safely or not. I don't want to put them through that. I don't know that I'm up for something like that again, but you know, never say never, but I don't see that coming down the pike.
Well, I'll save this recording for when I hear about it. But you know what, if this is the peak of high risk taking, I'd say it's a pretty high peak. So I think you can confidently live the rest of your life and say, you know what, I did something truly extraordinary. And I know, you know, there's a lot more lessons to come. And I know we're going to really look forward to hearing more about your reflection. So thank you so much for taking the time to tell us the story.
You. Thank you for your interest, Jenna.
Thank you so much to Bryce Carlson. As we mentioned, he's a high school teacher and he uses his adventure to enrich his life and by proxy the lives of his students. But to get the equipment and the support needed to set the world record, he had to take on some debt. So he has a GoFundMe page where we can help support him. And so far he's raised $40,000, but he's trying to raise $100,000. So he has a little bit of a ways to go. But hey, if he crossed the North Atlantic by himself, I'm pretty sure he's going to be able to accomplish this goal too. But he probably needs some help. BryceRose.com, BryceRose.com. Visit his website. You're going to see so much cool stuff there, but you're also going to see the link to his GoFundMe page. Definitely check it out. Thank you so much for listening to Smarter News. I'm Jenna. I'm so happy we spent this time together and appreciate your support. If you have a story idea or you just want to chat, email me, info@smarternews.com. Have a great day, wherever you are.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.